Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Speakers at this hour are asking themselves, what will it mean if a congressman who's married to a lobbyist becomes the next majority leader of the House, which is mired in a lobbying scandal? Lawmakers are behind closed doors right now choosing between three candidates to succeed Congressman Tom DeLay, who stepped down from the post to face charges of corruption and influence peddling. Today's leadership vote comes 1 month after super lobbyist Jack Abramoff alarmed lawmakers by pleading guilty to influence peddling in Congress. But there are already signs in Congress that lobbying reform is losing steam. Joining us on the line is Rick Klein, Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. And Rick, what's your informed opinion? What do you think is going on behind those closed doors?
Well, I think there really is a debate for the direction of the party right now. I think Representative Blunt, the person you refer to, who is married to a lobbyist, it does appear to be the front runner. He has more public commitments than any of the other candidates for majority leader. But there are two challengers, and they are both making the case that the Republicans really need to make a clean break in advance of the November elections, put something in here without the same kind of lobbyist ties and without the ties to Tom DeLay. Mr. Blunt was Tom DeLay's top lieutenant as majority whip and has been serving in a temporary capacity for a couple of months now.
Well, and as the Wall Street Journal editorial page points out, he is an unabashed fan of earmarks. These are the designer pork projects. So he sort of signals what direction he goes in.
Yeah, I mean, he has talked about them as an important thing to preserve, saying that members of Congress know better than bureaucrats where to direct money. But this is the process of earmarking has really gone out of control in recent years, where tens of thousands of special projects are inserted into bills, often at the direction of lobbyists.
Such as Roy Blunt's wife.
That's right, such as Roy Blunt's wife. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that I'm sure is going on now behind closed doors is the argument being made by the challengers, Mr. Blunt and his supporters, then, that really Republicans need someone who will come in and clean things up and say, we need real lobbying reform, we need real crackdown on these earmarks, we need real ethics reform, we need to separate ourselves from what's gone on in Washington over the last couple of years with Mr. Abramoff, with Mr. DeLay, and signal that we are headed in a new direction. But well, there's another push, and this is why Mr. Blunt is so much supportive, saying this is the tried and true hand, this is how we've preserved our majority, this is the guy that's brought us the tough votes, and we can't signal panic either. We can't admit, by putting in someone else in, we're tacitly admitting that there was a problem. So there's a lot of concerns about which direction to take it.
Well, the other direction might be taken by Roy Blunt's opposition, Ohio Congressman John Boehner, and by the way, his name is spelled B-O-E-H-N-E-R for those who've only read it and maybe not heard it, and John Shattuck of Arizona. Where do they stand on lobbying? What direction might they go in?
Well, both of them talk about a lot more reform and the need for a lot more reform, but I think widely considered that the true reform candidate is Mr. Shattuck, and this is something the editorial in the Wall Street Journal you referred to makes the point of, that he really is the cleanest break from the status quo. He's got the support now of the two congressmen who really led the drive to oust Mr. DeLay. That's Jeff Flake of Arizona and Charles Bass of New Hampshire. So John McCain, who's his home state senator and is very closely associated with some of the lobbying reform and ethics reform, has also endorsed his candidacy. So I think Mr. Shattuck is probably the cleanest break, but he's considered a long shot at this point. He has the fewest number of public supporters, something in the low teens at this point, and really would be something of an upset victory if he were able to pull out.
Well, he's also a politician who opposed the White House and didn't vote for the 2003 Medicare drug entitlement. Doesn't seem likely he'd get the leadership position.
Well, that's right. I mean, he opposed it because on conservative grounds, thinking that it spent too much money, as a number of conservatives thought. And conservatives are extremely powerful these days. They really were one of the reasons that Tom DeLay left. Not that Tom DeLay isn't a conservative, but they felt some of the conservatives feel like the Republican majority has strayed from its vision of the contract with America in 1994, gone away from the clean government aspects and the small limited government aspects of that. And I think that's why some of those conservatives have been pushing to see a clean break with the current crop.
Well, Rick Klein, before we let you go, lawmakers did easily pass their first lobbying reform measure yesterday. They banned lobbyists and their wives from the House floor and the gym. But that was ridiculed by members of both parties. Why? I mean, we did think a lot of business did go on in the gym.
Well, I think this is a point that the Democratic leader in the Senate, Harry Reid, made. He says, I've been going to the gym for 24 years, and no one has ever tried to lobby me there. And then he did add that not so attractive when he's naked, so maybe he wasn't surprising. But basically what Democrats have said is that this is just a fig leaf, that that they are addressing a problem that doesn't really need to be solved, that there isn't an epidemic of lobbying in the House gym on the House floor. What's also interesting, though, about yesterday's vote is that 50 Republicans actually voted against it and said no, they think that that there should be continued access on the gym. And I think what the signal they were trying to send is that there is not a problem in terms of the access of a lobbyist to members.
Yeah, and Republican leaders had to postpone releasing their larger package of reform.
That's
well,
right.
Rick Klein, we're going to keep staying in touch with you as they battle out who will be the leader behind closed doors. Rick reports for the Boston Globe, speaking to us from his office in Washington. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
Well, now to the other side of the aisle. In his State of the Union this week, President Bush characterized his critics as defeatist, isolationist, second-guessers, part of the problem, not part of the solution. Well, a card-carrying member of the left might, in part, agree. In his new book, Todd Gitlin, a veteran of the Vietnam-era protests and former president of Students for a Democratic Society, challenges his fellow liberals to be more than complainers, or as he writes, people who view history as a tank, their only job to stand in the way and block it. Todd says dissent can go hand in hand with patriotism, that one can be critical without being anti-American, and in so doing, revive the political left and maybe America itself. One way to get started, he says, maybe hang out a flag. Todd Gitlin is now a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University. His new book is called The Intellectuals and the Flag, and he joins us from the studios of Carnegie Hall in New York City. Welcome.
Hi.
I wonder, since writing this book, if you're not getting invited to as many cocktail parties as you were before. I mean, you really are tough.
Well, why not be tough? Anybody who thinks they are so knowing and shrewd and insightful about what the left ought to do in order to exist and matter as to ostracize people who are violating their brilliance are not the people I particularly want to drink with.
Well, there you go. And I'm wondering if those people might say, yeah, but Todd, you've sort of written the campaign for the right in this, you know, when you say that the left, if they had a manual, it would be what not to do. The right, if they had a manual, might be your book in its criticism of the left. Do you worry about that?
Not at all. The right is not the proprietor of patriotism. And to think that they are the actual, you know, that the people who tried to hang Osama bin Laden around Max Cleland or the swift boat albatross around John Kerry are not patriots. They are they're loudmouth violators of civility and pretenders.
And in fact, you go after the right as well. The fact that they could pull those things off, you say, is because while you profoundly disagree with them, the one thing the right has going for it is organization. As you say, the right now is a disciplined alliance with big, if crude, ideas, while the left has just become the place of negation.
They have a relatively simple problem because the right consists of two big blocks. There's the anti-tax, anti-government, pro-business block, and there's the Christian fundamentalist, theocratic tending block. And you can fuse them. You can fuse them, as the Republicans have been doing now for a quarter century, by throwing meat in those two directions. The left has a much bigger problem because we consist of a much larger number of groups. We don't have the sort of consensus. I don't mean to say that we don't have better ideas. We, you know, even without, you know, barely waking up in the morning, we have better ideas because the ideas that animate the right actually make no sense. You can't actually lavish care upon markets by at the same time lavishing care upon a president who brooks no opposition. And you can't actually acquire theocracy through libertarian means. So their position is a hash. Our position has not been as forward, has not been as streamlined, has not been as stark, and I would also add combative, as that of the right. But our ideas are actually more workable than theirs.
Well, and you say the biggest problem is that, and if I'm reading this correctly, that the left has sort of gotten used to being the losers, being out of power. And you come from a place where, you know, you sort of have the credentials to ask the question, doesn't defeat taste sweet if it's a good cause? I mean, a lot of protesters know that feeling and might have to answer to you, yeah.
Well, there is a nobility in defeat. You know, there's a long tradition of it. Walt Whitman celebrated failed revolutionaries alongside victorious ones more than a century ago. There are many ways of convincing oneself that one has won morally by speaking truth to power. It's a little late in the game for that. Certainly, it's a luxury, actually, for people who float around university-heavy zones like my own in Manhattan or yours in the Boston area. It's kind of thrilling to be on the margins, and you know, one can make actually a rather good living at it and meet all kinds of interesting people. The business of politics, however, is more practical, earthy than that. It has to do with actually winning power, and I know the word power kind of causes a shudder in our circles. It used to cause a shudder to run down my back because power was iniquity, corruption, self-defeat, etc. In fact, those who care about power are already half the way along to acquiring it. And politics is about the acquisition and use of power.
I want to go back to where you said you also had that feeling of, you know, the word power sending shivers down your spine. Was that during the student protest movements in the 60s and 70s?
It was in the late 60s. In the early 60s, let it be remembered, the fabulous success of the civil rights movement rested on a claim to power. That is, it rested on a claim that people were equally entitled in the United States of America to democratic rights, including the right to hold political office and to make political judgments. And that movement, the civil rights movement, had no qualms about embracing the symbols of American patriotism, including, you know, the face of Abraham Lincoln and the words of the Declaration of Independence and so on. It was in the late 60s because the American government was so intensely identified with the abominations of the Vietnam War that the left, or much of the left, and there were many exceptions, but there was a strand in the left that pugnaciously felt, well, okay, if the United States of America, in all its bloody history, is leading in an unerring direction toward napalm and the Vietnam War, then you have to renounce the whole thing. And the longer the war lasted, the more plausible emotionally that mood became. It was completely understandable. However, it was also misguided. It left us in a corner, so that even when in effect we won by helping bring an end to the war, we lost by having forsworn our claim to being the true representatives of the United States of America.
In fact, you write that having achieved an unprecedented victory in helping to stop an appalling war, the left then committed suicide. People so rejected authority that they decided not to ever take authority roles again. Well, these are provocative words from former SDS President Todd Gitlin. His new book is The Intellectuals and the Flag. And when we come back, why raising a flag in his New York City home in the wake of 9/11 in the shadow of the World Trade Centers woke Todd up to the thinking that the left had ceded the flag and patriotism to the right and how it needed to be seized back. Stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. Conversation continues with Todd Gitlin, former president of SDS, veteran of the student protests in the 60s and 70s, now a professor at Columbia University. In his new book, it's called The Intellectuals and the Flag, he cites three old school intellectuals, David Reisman, C. Wright Mills, and Irving Howe, as lefties who were committed to changing the U.S., not just criticizing it. He says the current crop does more complaining and should seize the offensive. And Todd, I know that September 11th marked a turning point for you in your thinking. Can you tell us a little bit about that? You lived right near the World Trade Center towers. You, along with others, had this horrific experience, as did all New Yorkers, of almost breathing in the effects of 9/11 for several days.
It felt automatic to my wife and me that we would express our solidarity with our injured people. Those being specifically New Yorkers, but also in some larger sense Americans. And it felt again, not like a major life decision, but simply a logical extension of that desire to go get a flag and hang it from the balcony. And then a reporter from the New York Times, who I knew, called me up a few days later, and having noted the proliferation of flags around New York, and said, well, what do you think of this? And so we talked about it. And so along the way, I mentioned that we had hung up a flag. And the next thing I knew, that fact became the lead of his column. And then people were debating whether I had committed treason or not. I was glad to hear that some people took the fact that somebody as rambunctious as I would hang a flag was a reason why, you know, one might not be consigned to the outer darkness for doing it. And there were certainly others who had their own versions of this sort of moment of existential truth and decided they didn't want to be identified with the nation state. You know, the sequel is that as the spirit of the nation, and I hear distinguish between the nation and the state, as the spirit of the nation dwindled and was replaced by the bravado and the jingoism of the state of George W. Bush, as that moment of national existence passed away and became a kind of conventional exercise of state power, I became less interested in declaring that I was a flag waver, and, you know, without ever thinking it was a burning moment of national significance, we took the flag down in the same sort of spirit as we'd taken it up.
I want to stay with your thinking about this distinction that you've just made and that you and your wife, you know, made between patriotism and nationalism, because I know you also around that time read George Orwell's 1945 essay Notes on Nationalism. I've got the book in front of me. In that essay, he distinguishes between the sort of English patriotism and nationalism. By patriotism, he wrote, I mean devotion to a particular place and a particular way of life, which one believes to be the best in the world, but has no wish to enforce on other people. Nationalism, on the other hand, is inseparable from the desire for power. That seems like part of what you really want to communicate in this book.
Yeah, actually, I would go further in my distinction than Orwell, as I wrote in there, because I don't even want to affirm that the American way of life is the best in the world. But I do want to affirm that it's mine, and that there are plenty of people with whom I share a common life condition. I have an even milder version of patriotism. But, you know, when I go abroad, and I've just been teaching in Tunisia for 3 weeks, I feel that I represent an approach to matters, a free spirit, an anti-authoritarian spirit, a concern, a cosmopolitan existence, a care about immigrants, and many, many values, which are genuinely mine. And I don't concede to George Bush that he's a better representative of those values than I, or many other people, for that matter.
So Todd Gitlin, again, former president of SDS, war protester, credentialed lefty, now author of The Intellectuals and the Flag. Do you think the left, which, as you painted, has gotten accustomed to standing on the sidelines and just criticizing, do you think the left has gotten maybe even too cushy? Because this isn't the left of your movement in the 60s. This is a left that's now in its 50s and is doing quite well. Are they prepared to step forward in the way you'd like them to?
People in their 50s are not going to be the vanguard of any movement that I have ever heard of. They'll be participants. They know some things, and they have some skills, and they have some money, and, you know, they're part of the thing. But they are not, you know, the fire that's driving the internal combustion engine.
And do you think that the fire is there in the young people you come across?
I see some young people who take all this awfully seriously. I was just at a meeting with a bunch of them this morning, in fact, who are involved in the Students Against Sweatshops. It's not an incandescent campus, and that's okay. I mean, you cannot repeat the 60s, but you have to live in this moment.
Todd Gitlin, former president of SDS and now author of The Intellectuals and the Flag. And Todd, I wanted to ask you, have you put yours up since 9/11? Have you become a 4th of July? No?
One of the things I argue in the book is that there's a real distinction between lived patriotism and symbolic patriotism. And we have much too much of the symbolic thing. I'm not somebody who's, in the flag business, but I am in the spirit of the flag business. People acting as though it is our country, and considering what we're obliged to do in its behalf. I mean, I know that sounds pious, but that's where I think real politics lies.
Todd Gitlin. His book is The Intellectuals and the Flag, and again he says the tragedy of the left is that having forced the U.S. out of the war in Vietnam, it then disconnected itself from the nation, that there's a liberal form of patriotism beyond protest. What do you think? As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program, anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org, letters@here-now.org, or you can call our listener line and leave us a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, a firsthand account of a flying intensive care unit making trips from Iraq on board ABC anchor Robert Woodruff and his cameraman Doug Vogt. We're going to speak to the reporter who was there and learn more about the intensive medical treatment soldiers are receiving in Iraq. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR in Boston. Amphetamine is a powerfully addictive drug that dates back to the 50s and 60s, but it has a powerful current reputation as well. It's known to wipe out families, destroy whole towns. A common assumption is that few meth addicts ever shake it, although a recent study suggests otherwise, as does the story of Thea and Candy Singer. The women, both sisters, know firsthand about meth's effects. Here and Now's Bob Oakes spoke with them after Thea, a Boston-based writer, watched Candy, who now lives in New Jersey, struggle with addiction. Candy started using meth when she was working as a juvenile defense attorney in Oregon.
You know, it's ironic because a lot of my clients were addicted to methamphetamine, and that's why their children ended up in foster care. So I actually knew quite a bit about the drug, and I helped a lot of people get into treatment. You know, but there was like this rash of deaths in Oregon, and you know, there was nothing I could do, and I started getting really overwhelmed.
You mean rash of deaths among the kids who were your clients?
Among the kids, yeah. You know, I got overwhelmed. I got really burnt out. I felt helpless. And so I actually decided to close my practice, and taking that away was pretty devastating to me because it was something I had done for so long. I had practiced for like 17 years.
Thea, how did you first notice the change?
You know, the whole family was really kind of blind. I didn't see Candy that often, but when I did see her, she was very skinny, and she was very hyper. And one thing that really struck me was I didn't want to go near her. There was something almost that repelled me.
How did you explain the change to yourself?
I had no explanation, actually. I was angry with her. I mean, it was more a visceral reaction. I didn't want to hug her, and I was pissed at her.
Candy, do you recall what it was like the first time?
That I used methamphetamine?
Yes.
You know, I didn't even realize I was high the first time. I just started doing kind of bizarre things, like I started taking pens apart and putting them back together with different pieces. And I would do that for hours, and it all seemed really logical to me at the time.
What did you think you were doing? Fixing
them? I thought I was making new pens that were better pens. I was making the best pens. Right, right. What's really scary about this drug is it makes you think that what you're doing is logical. And you think, you know, you're creating something when you're, in fact, not. You're just destroying things. I had stolen a lot of bicycles, and you know, I was a 44-year-old woman stealing bicycles and taking them apart and putting them together, thinking that I was creating like this great bike. So it really is in your own head because it's hours of this. I mean, you just do it for hours and hours, and everything became about staying high and making the drug and doing the drug and tweaking.
Thea, when did you come to realize that it was a drug addiction? When did you come to that realization?
It wasn't a realization, I was told, basically. It was my 50th birthday, and it got late at night, and I hadn't heard from her. and I'd heard from the rest of the world. And so I called, and my mother answered the phone, and I said, you know, I'm really angry. Candy didn't call me. And my mother basically said, well, don't be angry. And she said, something's happened. And then she said, methamphetamine. I don't even know if she pronounced it correctly. It's like she could barely get the word out.
I don't think my mother could have done anything. I don't think anything would have stopped me except getting arrested and put in jail. I mean, I was just so caught in the grip. I couldn't see that my behavior was bizarre, but I knew I was addicted to the drug.
You were arrested.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, I'd been burglarizing a lot of places, and someone saw me taking a computer monitor from one of the storage units. And the police came, and I was collecting people's IDs and licenses and credit cards, and I never did anything with them. I just collected them. And they saw that in the front of the car, so they had some probable cause to at least take the car. And I didn't want my mother to see me arrested in front of her. I was really concerned that that would make her health get worse. So I agreed to go to the police station. And once I started talking, it's like I couldn't stop. I mean, that became kind of like the tweak of, you know, because anything that felt good, I would do and do and do and do and do. And coming clean with what I've been doing and having a little bit of hope that I could get some help because I told them that I was addicted, felt good to me.
So it wasn't over by any stretch of the imagination. And also, you had to go through detox and rehab. Tell us a little bit about that.
The first 3 months were constant anxiety. I couldn't sit still. They medicated me, which helped. And then I went into like kind of a deep depression, knowing that I had completely ruined my life, and I just couldn't imagine how I was going to rebuild it. You know, there was a lot of shame. I felt a lot of shame, and I hated what I was doing, and I hated myself for doing it. And that made me want to use. But at the same time, I didn't want to go back to what I was doing.
Thea, what was happening in the family at that time?
Yeah. During this time, I spoke to Candy very little because she was in places where you couldn't just call her up. And I remember sending her a fax, you know, telling her I loved her. I had no idea what state she was in. And I remember speaking to her on the phone when she was drugged up, and it was horrifying.
What's your relationship like today?
You know, it's very close. You know, when I was using, everything was a lie. It felt really good to be able to be honest with Thea and have her not be judgmental of me at that time because, I mean, it hurt. Her anger hurt when I was, you know, when I was still in the rehabs, the first couple of years of my recovery. It feels good that that's over. I don't, you know, that she understands a little bit about what I went through. That she still loves me, and I love her.
I understand a lot. I have to say, I knew nothing. I knew nothing. I knew nothing about what was going on with Candy in her secret life. I knew nothing about this drug. I knew nothing about addiction. I mean, basically, she was fighting for her life. From the outside, you don't understand. And I feel closer to Candy now than I have felt. Oh, God, Candy, what would you say? Before she was a teenager. We've come back together, don't you, Candy, in a way that we haven't been for many, many, many years.
Candy, I can't end the interview without asking you, do you worry about being torn back into that world?
Well, you know, I mean, addiction's a disease, and it's a chronic disease. So it takes the same kind of care that any other chronic disease would take. Despite all the damage that it did, there are times that I still crave methamphetamine, you know, when I want to escape from myself and my feelings. You know, I remember where it took me, and I don't use, but, you know, that could happen.
How long have you been clean now?
3.5 years.
And counting. Candy Singer, Thea Singer, thanks very much for letting us talk to you, and good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Candy Singer, a recovering methamphetamine addict, and her sister Thea Singer, speaking with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. You're listening to Here and Now. Uh, surge in violence in the Darfur region of Sudan is threatening to derail peace talks aimed at ending the three-year-old conflict, which has claimed 200,000 lives and left 2 million people homeless. African Union officials are asking the United Nations Security Council to help stem the violence. That could mean sending UN peacekeepers to the area to take over for 7,000 African Union troops already in the region. The Sudanese government has said it will not allow UN troops on its soil. This latest development comes as Sudan recently lost its bid to take over the African Union presidency, a one-year revolving post. Well, joining us in the studio is Dr. Michael Van Rooyen of Harvard University's Humanitarian Initiative. He accompanied Physicians for Human Rights on one of three trips they made to the Darfur region in the past 2 years. The group just released a report on the genocide occurring there. And Michael, based on your experience in Sudan, first of all, what do you think the ramifications would have been if Sudan had gained leadership of the African Union?
Well, I think it would have severely undermined the credibility of the AU, the whole notion that the perpetrators of such crimes throughout their country and genocide in Darfur could actually assume the AU presidency is just ridiculous.
Well, let's move on to talk about the trip you made to the region. Physicians for Human Rights interviewed people at refugee camps in Chad after they'd fled Darfur. And in talking to the villagers, what did they tell you about the attacks that forced them from their homes?
It started, actually, with the government of Sudan bombing the villages first, sort of to prime the area. So they were bombed repeatedly for several days. Afterwards, the Janjaweed militia came in on horseback. The modus operandi was to come into villages, kick everybody out, kill heads of households, scatter people into the desert, take anything that was of value, and burn everything else.
In fact, you say the average household size in the villages you focused on, the average household size was cut in half from 12.1 to 6.7. I want to read a part of a quote from one of the women your group encountered in Chad. She says, "After traveling for 5 days on foot, we finally arrived at the border. Thousands of people were scattered along the riverbed trying to find shelter. We lived off berries and a little food supplied by the international organizations. My youngest child, a three-year-old girl, got sick. There were no medicines to help her. She died about a month before they moved us to the camp." That might not be counted in the initial assault, but it certainly is a side effect of it.
I think with all war, you know, there's the direct killing, the mines and the bombing and the assault weapons. But really the main mortality that comes as a result of war are things like malnutrition and things like lack of access to health and children dying in the field and displacement and communicable diseases. And we see this again and again, and certainly, you know, we saw it with this population in Sudan and into Chad.
Well, these stories of what is happening in Sudan are horrific, but much of it has been reported before. Tell us what's drawing so much attention in your report.
We focused really on looking at the issue of the Genocide Convention that looks at the deliberate loss of livelihoods and the deliberate destruction of livelihoods in this population in Darfur, because communities are very tightly knit. It's an extremely hostile environment. In general, it's very difficult to live. You just don't live on your own. And so by killing all of their livestock, essentially they ruin all of their life savings. By killing a donkey, for example, it's like removing your car and taking all transport that you have away. By killing the head of the household, you have no means to sustain yourself as well.
In addition to trying to make people aware of this, I would guess this report is also setting the stage for some future action. Is this about documenting what happened to these peoples for something down the road?
Yes, one of the recommendations is to set up a compensation commission that would require the government of Sudan to pay reparations to people who are returning. Physicians for Human Rights is suggesting taking oil revenue from the Sudanese government, having a third-party broker that compensation program, and linking it to the peace process if it's possible.
Boy, is there any sense that, given that they're still killing people in Darfur now, any sense that that would ever happen under the current government, that there'd be reparations?
Well, there's no way to see that at the moment. I think one of the things that would have to happen is the U.S. would have to broker an agreement and put significant pressure on the Security Council, in particular China and Russia, because they both receive significant resources and have significant business dealings with the government of Sudan.
Dr. Michael Van Rooyen is co-director of the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. He accompanied Physicians for Human Rights on one of three trips to the Darfur region during the past 2 years to document the genocide there. They've just released their report. Doctor, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
mailbag and air some of your thoughts. And many of you expressed them after we explored the issue of readoption. We spoke recently to USA Today's Wendy Koch, who reported on an online network of overwhelmed adoptive parents giving up their children to other adoptive parents, what lawyers called dump and run. But Susan Meyer, an adoptive parent of 30 children and the founder of the Foundation for Large Families, said it was simply parents providing a support system that was sorely lacking. Well, many of you appreciated our exposing the issue of overwhelmed adoptive parents, but more thought the issue was sensationalized. A parent who wished to remain anonymous writes, "I adopted 2 children from the Department of Social Services, and I don't know any parents who dump and run. By the time an adoptive family feels they can't care for their child, it's usually after years of failing to find support. When we tried to access help for one of our sons, we were told by the DSS they could only provide assistance if we terminated our parental rights. Now there's a catch-22. For post-institutionalized children adopted internationally, there's virtually nothing available. Believe me, there are no families beating down the doors to readopt these kids. They usually bounce from foster home to foster home due to behavior problems until they age out of the system. I would love to see you do a story on what is available to help these troubled children and their families before their loving parents feel there is no other option but to connect online with someone willing to reach out and help them." And Kathy Searman added, "You spoke as if adopted parents must have a different relationship to their children than birth parents. That adoptive parents become overwhelmed should come as no surprise. We often hear about overwhelmed birth parents seeking help from family members, friends, or the foster care system, or giving up their children for adoption. All parents could use some help." Amanda Bishop of Astoria, New York wrote, "After our report on Oprah Winfrey's public renunciation and excoriation of author James Frey, whose memoir she'd first touted, even after much of it was proven false." Amanda writes, "There are certainly problems with presenting fiction as fact, but I see more fault with Winfrey's ability to command so much attention. Her defense of the book wasn't well received, so she made a quick about-face, and Frey paid for her misstep." Well, finally, our piece on the new, whole wheat but still spongy version of Wonder Bread brought back memories for Derek Levin of Heartland, Vermont. He writes, "When I was a kid, 45 years ago, we used balled-up Wonder Bread as the best bait for carp. Of course, both the bread and the fish were equally inedible, the bread because of processing, the fish because of pollution. But it was nice to be able to eat the bait when we got hungry." As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town.
"Oh, my love is like a red, red rose that's newly sprung in June. My love is like a melody that's sweetly played in tune."
So begins "My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose," one of the most famous poems by Scotland's bard Robert Burns. Burns was only 37 years old when he died in 1797, but his words still sound in the halls of kings and commoners, especially around his birthday, January 25th, when Scots around the globe celebrate the life and work of their favorite son. Here Now producer Kevin Sullivan recently ventured to a Burns night at the Union Club in Boston.
Burns suppers range from a stentoriously formal gathering of aesthetes and scholars to uproariously informal rave-ups of drunkards and louts.
The Union Club of Boston has a smoky feel of an aging gentleman's club with immense brass-framed portraits and faded burgundy carpets.
Can I get you a drink?
Thank you, doll.
No.
During the mandatory cocktail hour, members of the British Officers Club of New England showed off their Scottish heritage and their legs.
"Well, I'm wearing what is known as day wear, which is a tweed jacket and a kilt and green hose.
This is the McLaughlin tartan, and it is the reds and the blues, and it's the family tartan.
It's very comfortable, yes. Although on a cold night like tonight, I was a little concerned going out with bare legs.
Women go through, right?
The room is swelling with pride as thick as a Highland brogue.
I've recently become involved with the Clan MacLachlan, and we still have a chieftain in Scotland. There's a castle.
My mother would turn over in her grave if she heard me talking like this, because I'm not a real Scot. I grew up in the northern part of England, but everyone's Scottish tonight.
Oh, Lord, When hunger pinches sore, do thou stand us instead, and send us from thy bounteous store a tup or wither head.
If you look at the poems, they seem on the first reading to be about very simple agricultural themes.
Her Majesty's British Consul General to Boston, John Rankin, is a Scot and resident Burns expert.
He wrote, to a mouse, but it has within it, it's supposedly about a mouse in the middle of a cornfield being frightened by the reapers coming into the field, but actually the poem's about mankind and the human condition, and he writes in it, the best laid schemes of mice and men gang after glay. Another one he wrote was To a Louse, supposedly about a louse seen on a woman's bonnet in church. But he writes within that, oh, would that God the gift would give us to see ourselves as others see us. And so these poems, supposedly on very simple agricultural themes, are actually about the human condition.
The most anticipated poem of the evening is the Ode to a Haggis.
His knife, see rustic labour dicht, and cut ye up with ready slift.
Are you ready to eat the haggis tonight?
Yes, sort of like a livery oatmeal.
It looks like a slice of meatloaf. It tastes a little bit more like pork. And I'd rather not smell it.
I don't know what it's made of.
Do you want to know?
No, you don't want to know.
The haggis is made out of sheep's offal. So it's like tripe made out of the hearts and lungs of a sheep and then cooked inside a sheep's stomach. Traditionally, one takes a lot of whiskey while eating it.
To help it go down?
I think that's so, yes. But I'm quite fond of it, actually.
Paul Taylor is the invited speaker, a fellow at Harvard's Weatherhead Center for International Affairs.
Take care, because I'm about to attempt a Scottish accent. And I hope it won't cause too much offence. John, I apologise in advance. A wee sleekit cowering timorous beastie. Oh, what a panic's in thy bristie. Thou needna start away so hasty. With bickering brattle, I would be laith to rein and chase thee with murdering pattle. I must apologise here, because I had to rely almost entirely upon Scotty in Star Trek and Private Frasier. Burns covers every emotion, from love to anger and from melancholy to sheer good fun. He had a real gift for baiting the pompous and bringing down those who, once in power, forget they're human like everyone else. O ye who are sae good yoursel', sae pious and sae holy, ye have naught to do but mark and tell your neighbours thoughts and folly.
The 19th century scholar J.S. Blackie once said, when Scotland forgets Burns, then history will forget Scotland.
I'd like to say, to the immortal memory of Robert Burns.
Our trip to the Bob Burns Night at Boston's Union Club was produced by Here and Now producer Kevin Sullivan. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and the